The title of this lecture is Jewish Life in Early America, Authority, Community, and the Challenge of Freedom. This July 4th, America will celebrate the 250th anniversary of its independence. And to mark this occasion, I want to give two shiurim on the Jewish experience in early America. So the theme of this year, this lecture, is we'll explore is Ein Chadash Tachas HaShemesh. There's nothing truly new under the sun. Many of the issues that animate Jewish communal life today can already be seen in embryonic form in some of the earliest documents in American Jewish history. And I want to share with you one of the first and foremost of these themes from the Jewish experience in the New World. And I'm going to share with you sources that were collected by Rabbi J.J. Schachter. We're going to learn some of them today. I think a useful way to approach early American Jewish history is to recognize that America did not begin with a single Jewish community or a unified structure of authority. Instead, it began with scattered individuals and small congregations, each improvising Jewish life in a new environment. As we will see, this decentralization shapes almost every aspect of early American Jewish experience, from halachic questions to communal authority to the role of rabbis and even to the meaning of Jewish identity itself. One of the earliest, perhaps the earliest surviving halachic responsa from the New World came from the Jewish community of Recife, Brazil, probably in the 1630s or 1640s. Many of these Jews were descendants of Spanish and Portuguese Jews who fled the Inquisition and found refuge in the more tolerant Dutch Republic. When the Dutch gained control of parts of northeastern Brazil, Jews followed them there, seeing an opportunity to build a Jewish community free from the persecution that had driven their families from the Iberian Peninsula. Living in the Southern Hemisphere presented them with a challenge that no earlier Jewish community in the Americas had faced. Their seasons were the reverse of those in Europe and the land of Israel. Rain was needed from Nisan to Tishrei rather than from Tishrei to Nisan. Now, to be sure, the issue was not entirely unprecedented. More than 300 years earlier, Rabbeinu Asher, the Rosh, had addressed a similar question from regions whose agricultural needs did not correspond to the standard the calendar for rain. But the Jews of Brazil now confronted the problem in an even more dramatic form. They lived in a hemisphere where the seasons themselves were reversed. The community therefore sent the question across the Atlantic to Rabbi Chaim Shabtai of Salonika. It's Shelos Tshuvos Torah Chaim, the Mahar Chash, Chela Gimel Simon Gimel. And the question read, Shela Shalchu Mitam Eretz Rechoka. They sent a question from a faraway land, Mimalchut Brazil, from the kingdom of Brazil, Shehu Makom Rechok Me'akava Shevel Tzadarom. It's very far from the equator on the southern side. And in the Tshuva, the question, writes for you most Ashenava Choseder Zmani Mishtanesha Mikaitz Lechoref, that the days of the year and all the order of the times are different over there from summer to winter. Shiyamosa Chabalahem Mitishrei Nisan, that the summer months are from Tishrei until Nisan. Vimosa Gashami, the rainy season is Minisan Vatishrei, is from Nisan to Tishrei. Rainy season is in the summer, and the sunny season is in the winter. And the rain is necessary during the summer, basically, from Nisan to Tishrei. And from Tishrei to Nisan, they don't need this. They don't need the rain. So they want to know, should we flip the... when we say V'Sein Talmata, when we say V'Mashiv Ruach. And Rav Chaim Shabtai answers the question, and he rules they should not alter the established wording of the Amida. Instead, if they need rain during their local winter, they should include the request in Shomea Tefillah. Now, the story has an ironic ending. The community had come to Brazil seeking refuge from the Inquisition, but that refuge proved temporary. In 1654, the Portuguese reconquered Recife and reestablished conditions that threatened the return of the Inquisition. And a small group sailed to New Amsterdam, today's New York. Thus, one of the first halachic questions of the New World emerged from a community that would soon disappear, but whose refugees helped lay the foundation of Jewish life throughout the Americas. This may be the first tshuva of the New World. Now, when 23 Jewish refugees arrived in New Amsterdam in 1654, after fleeing the Portuguese reconquest of Brazil, they encountered what was likely the first recorded instance of anti-Semitism in what would eventually become the United States. Remarkably, it occurred almost the moment that Jews set foot on American soil. Peter Stuyvesant, the governor of New Amsterdam, opposed their presence and sought to prevent them from settling in the colony. He wrote a letter to his superiors, and this is dated September 22nd, 1654. He writes, "The Jews who have arrived would nearly all like to remain here, but learning that they were very repugnant to the inferior magistrates, as also to the people having the most affection for you." They weren't nice, he says. "The deaconry also fearing that owing to their present indigence, they might become a charge in the coming winter." He's nervous because they're going to be a drain on society. So Peter Stuyvesant writes, "We have, for the benefit of this weak and newly developing place and the land in general, deemed it useful to require them in a friendly way to depart." We're basically telling them to leave. "Praying almost most seriously in this connection for ourselves, as also for the general community of your worships, that the deceitful race, such hateful enemies and blasphemers of the name of Christ, would be not allowed further to infect and trouble this new colony, to the detraction of your worships and the dissatisfaction of your worships' most affectionate subjects." They also, hateful enemies of Christianity. And he argues they should be excluded from the colony because of their religion and their perceived poverty. Stuyvesant's efforts ultimately fail. The Dutch West India Company, whose directors valued commerce and included individuals with ties to the Jewish community of Amsterdam, overruled him and ordered that the refugees be permitted to remain. Although Jews continued to face various restrictions, they won the right to stay. This episode serves as an important reminder that the American Jewish story begins with both opportunity and prejudice. The very first Jews to arrive in what would become the United States found religious intolerance waiting for them. Yet they also succeeded in securing a foothold that would eventually grow into the largest Jewish community in the diaspora. In 1772 in Lancaster, we find one of the earliest documented American instances of the arrangement known as the Shabbos Goy, associated with the Jewish merchant Joseph Simon. So basically, there's a letter that says the following, that quotes Simon said, this Joseph Simon said, "Gentlemen, today is my Sabbath, and I do not do business in it. If you will please to call tomorrow, I'll wait on you." We observe that the same reasons which prevented, I guess the non-Jews are writing this letter, and they write that we observe that the same reasons which prevented his payment of the order on that day would prevent our troubling him the day following. We apologized for intruding on his Sabbath and told him we would wait until Monday. He replied, "You're on a journey, and it may be inconvenient to you to wait." He went to call in his neighbor, Dr. Boyd, and took from his desk a bag, laid it on the table, and presented the order to the doctor. The doctor counted out the money, and we gave a receipt. The Jew sat looking on to see that all was rightly transacted, but said nothing, and thus quieted his conscience against the rebuke of a violation of his Sabbath. So this document basically tells a story of these Christians who wanted to do business with this Jew, and the Jew could not handle money, but he basically had a non-Jew look at the order, count the money, and the Jew may have been looking on, making sure that everything was kosher, or there was the correct transaction, but the Jew said nothing, and he had this non-Jew carry out the transaction on his behalf. Again, how do we look at this halachically? The point is, we have an instance in 1772 of a Jew being concerned about doing business on Shabbos, and he uses a Shabbos coin. There's a letter by Emanuel Josephson, dated 1784, and he writes the following. He's living in Philadelphia. And he says, "In order to manifest our gratitude for those peculiar favors and blessings, we ought in a very sincere manner observe a strict and close adherence to those Jews and commandments ordained by him and delivered to our master Moses." He writes that we should observe halacha. And the next paragraph he writes, "In order thereto, we, the subscribers, having taken these matters to heart and duly reflected on many defects this congregation called Mikveh Israel in Philadelphia labors under," so he was a member of the Shul Mikveh Israel, "and to our great regret and sorrow, we have find one in particular." He writes that there's one big issue, one big defect about our community, which strikes me most forcibly and cannot but affect with astonishment and horror every judicious and truly religious mind. This is the want of a proper mikveh. So he's complaining that there's no mikveh. It's interesting, in a shul called Mikveh Yisrael. So Mikveh Israel. So there's no mikveh. And this complaint underscores an early moment in American Jewish life when a small but serious effort was underway to construct a full halachic infrastructure in a context that lacked the institutional halachic structure of Europe. In 1785, Josephson, together with Joseph Wolf Karpeles, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that name right, they write a letter to Rav Shaul Halevi Lowenstam, the chief rabbi of the Ashkenazi community in Amsterdam, and they seek guidance on the fragile religious order in the new American setting. They describe a community struggling with intermarriage and the presence of informal religious functionaries who perform religious rites in a private capacity, often outside congregational oversight, and at times in tension with communal norms. And one episode they recount in a long letter, and it was a Jewish woman who became intimate with a non-Jew and became pregnant. She subsequently entered a marriage according to Christian, though not halachic, standards. Her father, upon discovering the situation, expelled her from his home. Seeking reconciliation, the mother wrote to Reb Mordechai of Philadelphia, her brother-in-law, who traveled to Easton, where the woman was from, in an effort to restore peace between father and daughter. Rumors circulated that he had performed some form of kiddushin, which he denied. Testimony later given by an individual named Barnett Levy claimed that he had been present with Reb Mordechai and the couple, and that he witnessed Reb Mordechai read a ksuva, the husband accept its binding force, and Levy himself signed as a witness. Mordechai strongly rejected this account. Complicating the matter, Barnett Levy was himself not considered a fully reliable halachic witness, as he was reported to be a public Shabbos violator and someone who ate non-kosher food. And the broader framing in the correspondence is striking. The writers emphasize that, especially in this country, where everyone does as he pleases, right? So it's like the pasuk from Shoftim, "Ish kol yasher meinav yaseh," and in this letter, it highlights the absence of centralized authority and coercive communal power, unlike in Europe. They write that the kahal has no authority to restrain or punish anyone. So the question that emerges from their description is how halachic order can be maintained, or even meaningfully enforced, under conditions of radical decentralization and communal fragmentation. One of the earliest Jewish voices to reflect on the challenges of America was an individual named Lazarus Cohen. He was a teacher in Unsleben, Bavaria, and he writes a farewell letter in 1839 to a group of Jews emigrating to Cleveland, Ohio. He doesn't fear persecution in America. Rather, he feared freedom. He writes, "Resist and withstand this tempting freedom, and do not turn away from the religion of our fathers." He warns the emigrants in the land where they would enjoy unprecedented civil rights and economic opportunity, they would also face powerful temptations to abandon Jewish observance of communal life. And he urges them to remain faithful to their traditions and to resist the pressures of assimilation. His concern reveals a defining feature of the American Jewish experience from its very beginning. Unlike in Europe, where Jewish identity was often preserved by external restrictions and social barriers, everyone had to belong to a kahila, to a community, America presented the challenge of voluntary continuity. The question was no longer whether Jews would be allowed to live as Jews, but whether they would choose to do so. Cohen's letter captures the paradox of America for Jews. It was a land of unprecedented opportunity and acceptance, but precisely because of that freedom, it posed new risks to the preservation of Jewish identity. What was the role of the rabbi in early America? In the colonial period, there was no real rabbinic institution in America as we understand it today. Jewish communities in places like New York, Newport, and Philadelphia were small and were led mainly by lay leaders called parnasim, by cantors and by teachers who handled the prayer services, education, and communal administration. Even in congregations like Sherit Israel wrote bylaws mentioning a rabbi, this was not yet the modern model of a fully independent halakhic authority. They write in their bylaws in 1790 that the duty of the rabbi, quote, "He is to have the charge of the morals of the children under his tuition and to teach what may be appertaining to our religious system." So number one, he should teach the kids, run a cheder, run a junior congregation. And then he writes, to conform to all things, that the Parnassim and the Junks and Ajutos may covenant with anyone that shall or may be taken up, engaged as a rabbi. Meaning, he should do whatever the Balabatim tell him to do. Real authority remained with the Parnassim, who controlled synagogue governance and could direct what he did. The first stage of change comes in the early 19th century, when American Jewish communities are still mostly without ordained rabbis, but begin to develop more structured religious leadership, such as educators and preachers like Isaac Leeser, who shaped religious life in Philadelphia without being formally ordained as a European Rav. The real turning point begins in the 1840s when the first European-trained rabbis arrive in America. The most important early figure is Rabbi Avram Reis, who came to Baltimore in 1840 and is considered the first permanently ordained rabbi in America. In this early rabbinic stage, even these rabbis often struggled to assert full authority, since American synagogue life was still heavily controlled by lay boards and operated more like democratic institutions than European rabbinic communities. This helps explain the She'erit Israel bylaws. They reflect a transitional world in which the idea of a rabbi existed, but real authority was still firmly in the hands of lay leadership long before the American rabbinate fully developed. George Washington's famous 1790 response to the Hebrew congregation in Newport, Rhode Island, most associated with the phrase that the government of the United States gives no bigotry to sanction, to persecution no assistance, is often read as a foundational statement that Jewish life in America would be fundamentally different from Europe. It signals a new model in which Jews are not merely tolerated as a protected minority, but are understood to be full citizens within a neutral state that does not privilege or punish religious identity. However, it is important to note that Washington did not originate this language. It was largely drawn from the congratulatory letter sent to him by the Newport congregation, by Moise Seixas, a letter from him dated August 17, 1790, says very clearly, deprived as we hitherto have been of the invaluable rights of free citizens, we now, with a deep sense of gratitude to the Almighty, disposer of all events, behold a government erected by the majesty of the people, a government which to bigotry gives no sanction, to persecution no assistance, but generously affording to all liberty of conscience and immunities of citizenship, deeming every one of whatever nation, tongue, or language equal parts of the great governmental machine. So basically, Washington took this language from Moise Seixas in his letter to Washington. It's also important to remember that this was not the voice of a centralized American Jewish community, because no such organization existed at the time. There was no OU, RCA, there was no organization of the United Synagogue of the Conservative Movement or of the Reform Movement. Just there was no central organization. In fact, multiple individual synagogues across the United States wrote separately to Washington, each representing its own leadership, priorities, and religious outlook. And Washington wrote this letter back specifically to the Hebrew congregation in Newport, Rhode Island. Washington, I guess in that sense, early Jewish American Jewish life was not a unified communal structure, but a collection of distinct synagogue communities, and much of American Jewish history from the very beginning reflects this tension between the autonomy of individual congregations and the idea of a broader American Jewish community. There is a letter by a woman named Rebecca Samuel, and it's dated from the 1790s. It was written while she was still living in Petersburg, Virginia, and it expressed her desire to move to Charleston. She writes, "The whole reason why we are leaving this place is because of the lack of Yehudishkeit. Dear parents are not quite well. You will not want me to bring up my children like Gentiles. Here they cannot become anything else. Jewishness is pushed aside here." So in this letter, she describes the isolation of Jewish existence in smaller southern towns, and she contrasts it with Charleston, which at the time had the largest and most established Jewish community in North America. But it's striking that her motivation is not primarily economic, but it's religious. She is drawn to Charleston because it offers the infrastructure of Jewish life, synagogue, communal worship, and a critical mass of fellow Jews with whom to share identity and practice. Her words highlight a central feature of the early American Jewish experience. In the absence of dense national institutions, Jewish life depended heavily on local congregations' size and strength. There was no overarching American Jewish community to provide cohesion. Instead, Jewish identity was experienced through the presence or absence of a functioning synagogue community in a given town. Her letter captures both the fragility and the geography of early American Judaism, where migration decisions were shaped as much by the search for Jewish communal life as by broader social or economic opportunity. You know, in his study of colonial American Jewish life, David de Sola Poole describes an interesting episode connected to the Chatham Square Cemetery in New York, associated with the early congregation Sherit Israel. The cemetery's shamash, the operations manager, sort of like the executive director, I guess, who was responsible for maintaining the grounds and overseeing burial arrangements, left his position in the mid-18th century. The letter writes that, De Sola Poole writes that his tenure of office came to an end in 1788 after 4 years of service. His was an aggressive character which led him into not infrequent difficulties and finally caused severance of his official relations with the congregation. So basically got into a fight with the people, with the Balabatim, and now they have to hire someone else. And De Sola Poole writes, among the five candidates for the position which he vacated were two women, Abigail Hayes and Rachel Myers. Now the candidate selected was Samuel Lazarus, who as shamash and collector served from 1788 until he resigned early in 1795. So the women were not selected, and Samuel Lazarus becomes the shamash until he resigns in 1795, and then Abraham Isaacs was chosen to succeed Samuel Lazarus. And then the Sola Poole writes that on his death in 1815, his name was put on the Congregational Perpetual Memorial List in consideration of his long services as being a faithful officer of the congregation. So he dies in 1815. And the Sola Poole continues, to fill the vacancy, in May of that year, his widow, Jeanette Isaacs, was unanimously elected as shamastress. Her many children were by then growing up, and to help her meet the practical difficulties, her son Joseph Isaac was authorized to attend to some of the more masculine congregational functions. This was an anomalous situation, though in the 16th century, synagogue in Rome had known a woman, Parnessa, whose function it was to take charge of charity grants for widows, orphan girls, sick women, and brides. Jeanette Isaac seemed to have remained the shamastress for 6 years, from 1815 to 1821. Essentially, this unusual title and appointment highlight the flexible and practical nature of early colonial synagogue life, where communal needs sometimes outweighed formal gender boundaries. While women were not part of formal religious authority, this episode suggests they could and did assume recognized functional roles within the congregation, especially in areas like burial, charity, and communal maintenance, where trust and continuity were essential. Now, the conflict, well, one more source, there was a conflict involving Rabbi Isaac Meir Wise, who ended up being a significant reform rabbi, but there's a conflict between him and his Balabatim in 1850. It shows how unclear synagogue authority still was in early American Judaism. There are different versions of the story. The initial objection by the lay leadership is described in two ways. Some sources say the problem began after Wise publicly expressed controversial theological views, especially denying traditional beliefs like the coming of the Messiah and the resurrection of the dead, while other accounts focus on his attempt to push stronger religious practice, including pressuring board members to close their businesses on Shabbos. In any case, in both versions, the core issue is the same. The synagogue leadership, the parnas, or the board, believed they had the right to control what the rabbi could say and do, Well, Isaac Meir Wise believed that he, as the rabbi, had the authority and the responsibility to lead the community religiously, including from the pulpit. And then Professor Sarna's book, An American Jewish History, he writes, during the services on Sabbath morning, the Parnas sent the sexton to me. I guess Isaac Meir Wise is describing this event. With the message, ex officio, the Parnas sends notice on you not to preach today. So he said he can't give the drasha. And Wise continues, I understood the declaration of war and the arbitrary assumption of power and retorted briefly, I shall preach today. I stepped to the pulpit at the regular time as the choir finished its hymn. The Parnas now arose in front of me and said threateningly, I tell you, you shall not preach today. I paid no attention to him and began to speak in a loud voice, which thoroughly drowned the voice of the Parnas, so that the people did not know why he was standing in front of me. He repeated his threat. I paid no attention to it and continued to speak quietly. The Parnas and a few of his adherents left the synagogue, but their action caused no disturbance. The gauge of battle had thus been publicly thrown, and both sides took it up. This disagreement, again, obviously escalated regarding the debate between the Parnas and Rabbi Isaac Meir Wise and whether he should give the drasha. Whatever the exact trigger, the episode reflects a deeper struggle in early American Jewish life over who actually runs a synagogue, the rabbi or the elected lay board. You know, if we step back from these sources, a single pattern emerges across more than two centuries of early American Jewish life. Whether in Recife, New Amsterdam, colonial synagogues, or 19th century America, we repeatedly see the same underlying structure. Judaism in America develops in a world without centralized authority, where communities are small, local, and largely self-governing. That reality produces recurring tensions between tradition and freedom, rabbi and lay leadership, communal unity and local autonomy, and halachic structure and social fragmentation. From Lazarus Cohen's fear of freedom, to Rebecca Samuel's search for Jewish community, to Washington's decentralized correspondence with individual synagogues, to the struggles of rabbis like Rabbi Abraham Rice and Rabbi Isaac Meir Wise, American Jewish history begins not with stability, but with negotiation. And in that sense, these early sources are not just historical curiosities. They are the blueprint for much of American Jewish life that continues to this day, a community defined less by hierarchy than by conversation, and less by uniformity than by the ongoing effort to hold together freedom and continuity.